Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Robert Holly with Home Healthcare News. Before we jump into my conversation with National Association for Home Care and Hospice President Bill Dombey, I want to give a shout out to our podcast sponsor, Homecare Homebase, whose powerful cloud-based home health software streamlines virtually every aspect of your business. Spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering quality care to the patients who need you. Visit hchb.com to learn more. Since taking over as president of NAC in early 2018, Bill has spearheaded the organization's advocacy efforts on Capitol Hill on behalf of its 33,000 or so home care, hospice, and home health members. With things like the patient-driven groupings model and the review choice demonstration, 2018 has been a busy year for NAC. 2019 is likely to bring more of the same with congressional changes and increased oversight, especially for the hospice industry. Bill shed some light on his advocacy plans for the year ahead. Bill, welcome to Disrupt. Excited to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation, Bob. Always good to work with you guys.
So before we jump into questions, I have to ask you and let our listeners kind of know where my allegiances lie. I am from the Chicagoland area, so I'm among the group of people out there who says NAC instead of NOC as president. Where do you land on the NAC versus NOC conundrum?
Well, the board of directors over 30 years ago preferred that the acronym be pronounced NAC rather than NOC. Yes, they wanted to avoid knock-knock jokes, but... You know, so long as people recognize us the same way, whether it be NAC or NOC, we'll take it.
Just to be clear, people in the Chicago area with our thick, heavy accents are saying it correctly with NAC.
That is correct. And I don't ever hear a Chicagoland accent. I think it's perfect English.
Glad we got that important point out of the way right off the bat. If you're just tuning in for a little bit of background, NAC is a nonprofit. Bill, you took over as the organization's interim president in 2017, officially named president early in 2018. Of course, you've been with NAC for years and years prior to that. Without getting into too many specifics, what have been your top priorities since taking over the reins there at NAC?
Well, the priority really is to prepare NAC for today and most importantly, even tomorrow in terms of the world of advocacy and education. And that means transforming NAC in ways that we hadn't operated, primarily focusing in on a transformation to a member-driven, member-owned, but member-engaged organization, because we see the real power of home care advocacy comes not only from NAC here in Washington, D.C., but from our members at large with the compelling voice, the very persuasive circumstances of home care and hospice that could be added in an advocacy perspective, grassroots and otherwise. So that transformation into being just a powerhouse voice, both in Washington as well as out there in the rest of the country.
And that's really about, you know, bringing the thousands of home care agencies, the thousands of home health agencies, and then there are hundreds of workers just all together kind of as a way to, you know, shape policy and make sure that the home health, hospice, and home care industries are strong in D.C.
Exactly. You know, I mean, home care and hospice is real life. And bringing that real life into the advocacy side as compared to your typical Washington, D.C., silver-tongued, heavy-moneyed lobbyists with fundraisers for politicians on a regular basis, we really think that the convincing of policymakers, be they in Congress or at regulatory agencies, comes by way of bringing that real life to them in a three-dimensional way. That comes from our members. It comes from those who provide the care on a day-to-day basis. You know, we would hope to be able to guide that, hope be able to shape it in ways that become more than just convincing to a point of creating a loyalty towards home care and hospice within the policy side of healthcare. And it's really the best place to be in healthcare today. And let's amplify that through our advocacy efforts using every one of those millions of workers who provide home care and those thousands of companies that arrange for those services.
All right. So speaking of those advocacy efforts, I think this is the perfect time having you on Disrupt. There's a lot of change going on in home health, home care, and hospice. There's a lot of change happening on Capitol Hill. We have a new Congress coming in. the U.S. House of Representatives has shifted to be Democrat-controlled. The Senate, of course, is still narrowly Republican. What are your thoughts on the new Congress? What can providers expect in the near term?
Well, in the near term, you know, we expect to see a very busy Congress when they come back in January and start with a Democratic-controlled House, but still a Republican president and a Republican Senate, which means that not much will get done unless they work together. And the good part of home care and hospice is that we've had longstanding bipartisan, bicameral support. So we'd expect Congress, you know, when coming back, to deal with maybe some more small ball things rather than, you know, big time reforms. You know, we don't expect to see major reforms in the structure of Medicare or Medicaid as was contemplated in previous years. Instead, there are a lot of small reforms that can be done that we think would be helpful. And we think the Congress is ready to take on some of those kinds of reforms, and that we would very much expect to see, you know, a bipartisan willingness with the White House support for those kinds of small reforms. Sometimes we call them cats and dogs in Washington. Sometimes we call some of that legislation a Christmas tree bill. But I think it's just really just ongoing improvement as well as maintenance in very important healthcare programs. So we would expect the first 3 to 4 months in Washington next year to be extremely good. Excuse me, I say next year. We are already there. It's a problem of getting over the date line. But we expect 2019 to be a very busy first quarter.
What are some examples of smaller reforms or cats and dogs, as you said?
Well, we certainly think that there's room for continuing the regulatory relief efforts that started in 2018. There have been, you know, a number of steps taken both by CMS as well as by Congress to reduce paperwork burdens, to reduce some of the traps in the administrative structures that, you know, can catch somebody on a claim submission, or some of those administrative obligations that just represent costs without any value. So when looking at that, we'd be looking at some of the documentation issues that affect hospice and home care, some of the conditions of participation that we think are outmoded, and even, you know, taking a look at some of the things which would modernize the Medicare program. The top of the list for me in terms of modernizing it would be allowing non-physician practitioners to actually certify Medicare eligibility for home health in particular, where we see non-physician practitioners like nurse practitioners and physician's assistants as the primary practitioners seen by many of these patients. This is should not be a major reform. It may have major value, but it's a minor reform to bring it up to 2019 standards.
We actually spoke not too long before this. What we just talked about now, of course, is on the congressional side of things. When we spoke before, you mentioned how there might be changes coming down from the White House as well, maybe in the form of healthcare cuts as the Trump administration looks to perhaps trim government spending. Is that something providers should be on the lookout for as well?
Absolutely. You know, an unfortunate consequence of working with government programs is the unpredictability of payment rates. And the White House last year proposed cuts to all post-acute care providers in the Medicare program. We do anticipate that that proposal will come about also again this year in 2019. And the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission met in December and will meet again in January, and a report will go to Congress in March. And the handwriting is on the wall already for MedPAC. It's going to be recommending a cut in payment rates for home health of 5%. This is a repeat of something we've seen for in previous years, and they're going to recommend that hospice receive a 2% reduction in their inflation update, which is pretty close to freezing hospice rates. So that is, you know, something that we look out for every year, but there's just a lot of buzz going on, you know, regarding reducing the spending for post-acute care services in a variety of ways, and those straight inflation rate cuts and the like are a threat we cannot ignore.
So that's in contrast to the steps CMS has taken for home health reimbursement in 2019. If I have my numbers remembered correctly here, I think CMS actually increased home health payment rate for 2019 to a little over 2.2%, maybe 2.2%, something to the tune of $420 million. Doesn't sound like a ton. You know, we're dealing with billions and billions of dollars. But do you think that rate increase, at least in 2019, will make a difference to home health providers and their ability to kind of thrive in today's market?
Yeah, well, it was not actually CMS's choice to do that rate increase. It was built into the law that Congress had put in place. And so if CMS had the discretion, we don't know where they would go. We think we have an idea, and it's not a good place to be. But Congress allowed for that inflation update. And it, really, it's the first update in payment rates, increase in payment rates, since about 2011. And most of those other years were reductions of inflation updates, case mix creep reductions where CMS does go sometime, but also the rate rebasing that occurred from 2014 through 2017. So, you know, will the $400+ million make a difference to home health agencies? I think anybody who receives a rate increase, it will make a difference, giving them some resources to deal with staff compensation, to deal with improving their technologies, just day-to-day kinds of ways of managing their budgets that they might have. So we are going to see an increase in base payment rates in 2020 also. It will be set at 1.5%. But you know, with PDGM, there are three other things up in the air up there. So I think the home health agencies are very much welcoming a first-time increase for some of them. Some of them don't even remember what 2010 looked like when they got an increase, because that's been nearly a decade ago.
Yeah. So you mentioned PDGM. That's perhaps one of the biggest changes that we've seen in the past several years. I know that we report on it very frequently. I'm sure you get tired about talking about it for the past several months, but I have to bring it up while we have you on the line. You know, there's a lot we could talk about, having the unit of payment, LUPAs, but I thought I'd kind of ask a more global question. You know, in your view, how will PDGM change the home health landscape on a more macro level?
Well, probably the greatest risk in change is for home health agencies to react to the elimination of the therapy thresholds, which affected the level of reimbursement, and to react to it by reducing therapy services to their patients. Back when the prospective payment system came into play in October 2000, home health agencies immediately gravitated towards the incentive of providing therapy visits, and it really brought great improvement in patient outcomes as a result. Less reliance on personal care supports of a home health aide, more restorative actions or maintaining function for patients. Now, getting away from that financial incentive, we hope that the clinical incentive remains there to deliver the therapy services. But there are absolutely rumblings out in the home healthcare community about stepping back from the volume of therapy, since it's no longer going to bring the level of reimbursement. We caution agencies in doing so, because healthcare generally is shifting towards a value-based type payment arrangement. There are 9 states already in a home health value-based purchasing program. And if the withdrawal of therapy services triggers lower patient outcomes, worse patient outcomes, there are going to be financial consequences that outweigh whatever financial benefits come by reducing the visits. So from a transformational perspective, that's the number one area that we will be watching and trying to counsel home health agencies, advise home health agencies on how they should manage under PDGM. Is that change in the focus towards therapy services. That could have really global patient spectrum-wide impact across the home health service delivery model.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to when I attended the NAC Financial Managers Conference a couple months ago. I think you had a speaker who said that these changes, shouldn't be a death knell to therapy services, that providers should take this opportunity to really show the value of therapy and, keep doing it, even though PDGM might have some of those changes you talked about.
We would expect agencies might have some pressure to reduce the volume of therapy, but they still have to put their patient first, and therapy is one way to figure that out.
I know one of the more controversial aspects of PDGM is the behavioral adjustment aspect. CMS kind of calculating things and calculating budget neutrality based on a certain set of assumptions rather than observed behavior. think that behavioral adjustment aspect is something we're going to for sure see come by 2020?
Well, yeah, I mean, from a Medicare home health advocacy perspective, this is issue number one for us. The 6.42% that was in the proposed rule was not finalized by CMS. Instead, CMS finalized that they would be doing a behavioral adjustment using factors such as upcoding on diagnosis, added visits to avoid the LUPA thresholds that are in the model. We have significant congressional support that have already voiced that their willingness to be with us throughout 2019 on this issue. And we certainly hope that we can make the improvements we see necessary in any behavioral adjustment processes there. So we'd be looking at two elements there. One, the timing of any adjustment, and two, the depth of that adjustment. Timing-wise, you know, our advocacy focuses in on waiting for changes to actually occur and be measured by CMS before they reduce rates instead of relying upon assumptions that are really dangerous. The second is the depth of that kind of adjustment that would be there. The law provides for possibly an upward adjustment as well as a downward adjustment, but clearly CMS focuses in on the downward adjustment. And history tells us that home health agencies' behavior is not consistent with payment models, that we have seen behaviors change where they reduce the number of patients being served, thereby reducing spending the opposite direction. Sometimes we've seen in changes in volume of therapy visits to increase payment rates or upcoding on diagnosis that increases payment rates. So we think the assumption-based approach is a high-risk venture in terms of delivering care to patients and under the home health benefit. That's why we want to push it off to after change has actually occurred. We feel pretty optimistic about our chances on that, but that optimism really is strengthened by our belief that we can get our home care members to join in the advocacy efforts with grassroots messaging to their congressional delegation.
Do you think that the home care industry or the home health industry, and you know, when we're looking at providers overall, do you think that they're prepared for PDGM? And just as a quick side note, you know, I go to a lot of events, go to a lot of conferences, and inevitably each time, you know, I will talk to some operators who perhaps aren't very familiar with it. So do you think providers are prepared? And then on the other side of the coin, what's NAC doing to educate its members?
Well, I think, you know, home care, home health agencies as a part of home care are a diverse lot. They are diverse in terms of size. They're diverse in terms of their patient mix and so on, but they're also diverse in terms of their efforts to be prepared for change. Home health agencies have been remarkably capable of dealing with change. When I look at PDGM, I don't see the industry across the board as prepared for PDGM as they should be at this point, which is not prepared to start it tomorrow. I mean, it doesn't start until January 1st, 2020, but it's going to take a lot of work to get from today to 2020 to be successful on it. So we really think that the agencies need to step up their preparatory efforts, and they are top to bottom. You know, focus on everything from operations and clinical practices to their financial management to even their data analytics internally and their use of technologies. So one of the things that we're doing, in addition to the advocacy to try to help resolve some of the concerns around PDGM, is we put together a 12-sided national summit on PDGM, where the faculty are the nation's foremost financial operations and clinical experts coming from the consulting firms. All these firms have joined forces with us and the state home care associations to put on this set of programs nationally. All four corners of the country are available in that, and it's a one-day intensive program that we think, you know, by holding it early, will spur the home health agencies into a preparatory mindset and really get them to a point of actually successfully adjusting to PDGM. PDGM is intended to be a redistribution of payments, but overall to be budget neutral, which means all agencies have a chance to be successful under the new model.
we could probably talk about PDGM alone for the duration of this conversation, but I do want to cover some ground, talk about some other topics, some other big points. One of the things going on in home health, also from a regulatory perspective, is CMS's review choice demonstration, kind of a revived version of pre-claim review. It's my understanding that the review choice demonstration, or RCD, is meant to combat improper billing, but improper billing was also shown to be down, at least according to the most recent CMS data. What's going on there? It seems to be some conflicting messages there. Improper billing down, but let's tighten things up when it comes to improper billing.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing actually is, I think, the outcome of what we've been hoping for with the efforts that the industry has taken internally, but also efforts from Medicare and its contractors to reduce the problems with documentation. Because while the improper payment rate rose as high as 59% 2 years ago, it was related to documentation. And when you see documentation errors, the first message you get out of that is these are fixable. These aren't home health agencies that don't know what Medicare covers and doesn't cover. These are not wholesale bringing on patients who don't meet Medicare's homebound requirement or have a medical need for the services. It's about crossing T's and dotting I's correctly. And so over the last several years, there have been efforts around improving awareness of documentation requirements and also steps to reduce some of the documentation requirements that are out there that have been nothing but confusing, for example, around the face-to-face physician encounter. So those efforts are paying off in reducing the improper payment rate down to 17%. So what we believe we're seeing now is the Office of Management and Budget and perhaps even CMS slowing down the review choice demonstration program by rethinking whether it's really necessary. We don't have proof of that, but there is a logical connection. The improper payment rate comes down. It comes down in states in addition to where pre-claim review is in. It's becoming a national corrective action rather than targeted, and it didn't cost the $400 million that the review choice demo has budgeted for a five-year project that only hits a handful of states. So we do hope to see that CMS recognizes the progress that's been made in using much less costly, much less burdensome processes to correct documentation.
I actually have to give New Jersey a quick shout out. I was looking at the improper billing data yesterday from CMS, which you actually flagged for me. So thank you for that. And I think New Jersey had like a 3% improper billing rate. So good for New Jersey.
Yeah, obviously some people, when it comes down to documentation, may have more proficiencies than others. But when you think about it, to go from 59% nationally down to 17% nationally, that meant all of the states have improved their game. And we still see room for improvement, but we also see room for improvement on just the documentation requirements themselves. You know, one of them, CMS, finally listened to us. We said, you need to get rid of the requirement that physicians in recertification periods state how much longer care would be needed, almost trying to get it date specific. And in the most recent rulemaking, CMS eliminated that requirement. So that's good progress in terms of regulatory and paperwork burdens, while at the same time, home health agencies up their game on it. So head in the right direction. It truly doesn't make any sense to throw the review choice demonstration project in the middle of all this, spending $400 million that we could really use for patient care instead.
Shifting gears again in a completely different direction, another one of the big topics that we're constantly reporting on here at Home Healthcare News is Medicare Advantage and its growing role. You know, Medicare Advantage is far outpacing traditional Medicare, just on kind of a year-by-year outlook basis, gaining more and more beneficiaries each and every year. In your view, Bill, is that a good thing?
We at NAC do see that there is Medicare Advantage out there, but we within NAC and within our membership have yet to see the real positives coming from Medicare Advantage plans. When we look at it in a general sense, there are some plans who recognize the value of home health services and have embraced it in so many ways in order to bring patients from inpatient settings home or to keep them home in the first place. But when you look at it in the aggregate, you know, you see the following out of Medicare Advantage. We see administrative headaches and burdens, having to jump through all kinds of hoops to get a visit authorized here and a visit authorized there. And even home health agencies who deliver care for free to meet patients' needs because they can't handle the administrative, you know, hoops that have to be jumped through to get approval from the plans. We see bad tape. We see bad payment rates coming from Medicare Advantage plans. The only reason why home health agencies can continue to deliver care to Medicare Advantage plans today is because they're by and large getting a margin on traditional Medicare payments, a margin that MedPAC criticizes and says we need to cut payment rates. But Medicare traditional payment rates are subsidizing Medicare Advantage. So if we see a growth in the proportion of Medicare Advantage, it's going to destabilize the industry. So we really think, you know, the plans have to open up their eyes and ears to the value of home care. But unfortunately, we continue to see the plans more concerned about unit prices rather than in terms of dynamic value. We are starting to see some plans moving in more in that direction. Obviously, Humana, one of the purchasers of one of the largest home care companies out there, Kindred, must recognize the value of home health and by stepping so big into direct delivery. Mm-hmm. So the future looks like more and more Medicare Advantage, but the future looks like, you know, a combination of our advocacy shifting attention to Medicare Advantage, but also the behavior patterns of the home health agencies. You know, we can't advocate for them to refuse a payment rate, violates antitrust law, but we really do think home health agencies need to understand their costs and how it relates to those payment rates, where they could get themselves in serious trouble.
So CMS, I think it was in April, when they announced that non-skilled in-home care would be covered as a supplemental benefit under MA plans for 2019. When we ask around about this, you know, most people say not a lot of opportunity next year or in 2019, more so in 2020, especially in 2021. Want to get your thoughts on that. But then I also wanted to ask you, a lot of people think that eventually there's going to be a hospice carve-in under Medicare Advantage. What are your thoughts on those two topics?
Well, on the first one, you know, it's always a positive to provide support for people going home. We think that there's even room to do that on the Medicare traditional program through ACOs, through some of the innovative programs like post-acute care bundling. And so we would hope that CMS opens the door for consideration of that. At the same time, we would agree with you that the plans will probably step more into that supplemental health benefit mindset that could include personal care in 2020 rather than 2019. The plans have said they really didn't get enough forewarning about this, so they haven't been able to crunch numbers and really understand it. So they'll be doing that down the line. Whether the home care companies will be there to provide those services remains to be seen. Experiences around Medicaid-managed personal care services in the home indicate that the payment rates the plans are willing to pay are far below what commercial rates would be or private pay rates would be. And we have a real shortage of personal care services workers across the country. And that means businesses will be making decisions. Do you want to sell it to somebody privately for, say, $25 an hour? Do you want to sell it to a managed care plan for $15 an hour? I think the answers are pretty apparent there. So it looks good on paper. It looks good as a philosophy, but will it be a practical concept that has value? I don't know. I think the jury's out on that and remains for a lot to be seen.
I was going to ask about the hospice carve-in then. You know,
hospice carve-in would be the biggest revolution in the hospice benefit probably since the hospice benefit began. You know, a long time ago, Congress felt that hospice was a unique benefit, serving unique needs in a unique population, and decided to keep it outside of Medicare managed care under whatever name it was using at the time. It was Medicare Plus Choice at one time, and now it's Medicare Advantage, for example. And so they saw value that's there. They are now talking, and just in fact, I mean, finance committee members are talking about it, policy people outside of Congress, including MedPAC, talking about doing something of this nature. So we can't ignore it, but at the moment, we would say it's not a good move to make. It's a real risky thing to take such a well-established service delivery model and insert it into a whole new management and payment system called managed care. And if the experiences with home health have any kind of, you know, information that could apply in the hospice context, you know, administrative burdens and paperwork become a concern. But one of the things we've seen in managed care that we would be concerned about affecting hospice is taking the core concept of hospice as a bundled, interdisciplinary, managed end-of-life care for individuals and start piecing it out and taking away some of the flexibilities as well. So if somehow the system chooses to go down that path, whether it be a demonstration program or otherwise, where we will be saying, you've got to preserve the integrity of hospice as a delivery model, meaning interdisciplinary, bundled services, flexibility to use everything from chemotherapy for pain relief to music therapy or pet therapy, something that brings comfort at the end of life. So this is, on the hospice scheme of things, clearly the biggest issue for hospice to be focused on.
While we're still on the topic of hospice, again, I think it was at the Financial Managers Conference toward the middle of 2018, I think you told me that the hospice honeymoon is over in terms of scrutiny and regulation and oversight. I know just from paying attention to what OIG is saying, that certainly seems to be the case. Are we still kind of on track for that honeymoon being over in your perspective?
It is over, but it's not with any harshness that it's over, meaning when people are looking at hospice reforms today, they are very cautious. When they're looking at oversight, they're also cautious, but they are engaging in reforms and oversight. You know, it wasn't too long ago that hospice claims were never reviewed. Now you even have, you know, all of the various Medicare contractors looking at them, and there are whistleblower cases being brought by parties working for hospices under the Federal False Claims Act, and the Inspector General's office has a work plan that focuses in on hospice as well. So when I say the honeymoon's over, it means it's gaining the traditional attention from oversight bodies, and it's gaining the traditional attention looking at payment reforms. But when looking at those things too, you see a baby step. The payment reform that took place in hospice, a very small step to break up payment rates between the first 60 days and after 60 days, and to offer a service intensity adjustment at the end of care for those individuals who die during hospice services. So you see a cautious, conservative, very deliberative approach, but it is still attention. And that comes by way of being a $15 billion a year spend, $15, $16 billion a year, affecting, you know, 1.5 million individuals. Half of the people who die in Medicare, you know, have used hospice in the last year of their life. So it is there, but it is not there where it's time to panic in the streets, watching out for arbitrary and capricious action. Things are going on with a bit of caution. But a lot, you know, can be learned from the path taken in other healthcare sectors. The one we're most familiar with, obviously, is home health, and you're seeing similarities, but with a little slower speed and a little more caution.
All right, we only have a few minutes left here. While you're still on the line, I kind of want to get some forward-looking projections for the rest of 2019. It's going to be a big year for home health, hospice, and the home care industries. I think a lot of people agree. Let's go one by one in just a sentence or two. What are some things that you're expecting for each space in the rest of 2019, maybe even beyond regulation? Let's start with home health.
I think, you know, what we're expecting is, you know, a continued pressure from workforce shortages, skilled services, as well as home health aides and personal care services, and finding agencies looking to a variety of innovative approaches to bolster their workforce. So the demand, it's a good thing in some respects. It means the demand is greater than the supply, but it's a difficult thing to create a workforce overnight. So that would be the top of my list of what we're looking at for 2019 is a lot of pressure on the workforce, provided the economy remains as strong as it has with an unemployment rate as low as it is.
And that's, you know, probably
it's
something.
It's very difficult to retain workforce unless we could pay higher compensation, particularly the personal care service workers.
I was going to say that's probably a point that would hold true across home health, home care, and hospice, is just workforce challenges.
Absolutely. Yes.
All right. Well, that's Bill Dombey, president of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice. Bill, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Disrupt.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com. I'm Robert Holly, and this has been a production of AG Media Network, Chicago, Illinois.